A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 350. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure computer game. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England.
And this is Bobby Blackwolf from the Voice of Geeks Network and based out of Atlanta in the US.
Excellent. Welcome aboard. So we are continuing our yearly spin-off episode where we look at a spin-off from one of the TV shows we have previously covered. And this time, as we say, we're looking at the 1984 text adventure computer game based on the hugely popular Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy franchise from Douglas Adams. And if you want to hear our episodes about the show on British television, you have to go all the way back to 2008. British Invaders 12 and 13.
That's right. And of course, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was coming out in a lot of different forms and a lot of different platforms in a relatively small period of time. And one of the well-remembered ones was this computer game. And Eamon, you and I are not really computer gamers.
Not at all.
Yeah, so we thought it was a good idea to bring someone in to give us a hand on this. So thank you, Bobby, for helping out with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the game was created by Douglas Adams and Steve Moretzky for Infocom in 1984. And like a lot of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on various platforms at that time, it was popular. It became a big success.
Now, last time we talked about the software that it was designed in, and Bobby, you're a bit more of an expert on things like Muddle and in particularly Zill than we are. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so Zill is it stands for Zork Interpretive Language, which is what Infocom used to create all of their text adventures. And the brilliance of them doing that, especially back in the 80s, was that they created their own kind of functional programming language that their writers could use to make games. But then for each computer, they only needed to create a compiler, which meant that when a new computer came out, all they had to do was port their Zill compiler to that computer, and suddenly their entire back catalog could be available for that computer just like that, because they didn't need to change the underlying files of each particular game. So like when the IBM PC came out a couple years after Infocom had already made hit games like Zork and Hitchhikers and Leather Goddess of Phobos and stuff like that, all they had to do was port the compiler, and suddenly their entire catalog was available on the IBM PC. So that was the great part of what they did with Zill. And the interesting part of that is that while we have the source code for many of these games, in fact, the source code for the gold edition, the solid gold edition of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is actually available on GitHub and you can read it. Nobody has ever found an original Zill compiler for any computer. So those have been lost to time. They were probably stored on floppy disks that have had bit rot in the since then, or they were thrown out in the attic when people unfortunately passed away, because we're getting to that point where people who were big software developers in these late 70s, early 80s, probably, where families are clearing out their attics. But what we've been able to do is, all is not lost, is that the Zill language has been reverse engineered, because we have the Zill files for a bunch of these games. And so there are new Zill interpreters out there that can compile these games where they don't have to change anything from the original thing. But we don't actually have any of the original ones developed by Infocom. Those have been lost to time.
And we talked, I think, last time, and I will share this link on the Facebook page when this episode comes out. We've seen a clip of Douglas Adams himself on the BBC's BBC Micro TV program talking about Zill and about some of the programming of the game, and also talking about what he describes as a user-unfriendly approach to the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it was tough.
Yes, because like if you actually look, on GitHub, which is a big source control, like a lot of programmers use it. I use it for work for source control of my source code for developing, because I'm a software developer in my day job. You look up the user is historical source. And they actually have a whole bunch of old games from the 80s, including like some Sierra adventure games. They have the source code to that. But they've got a lot of Infocom games, including Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And if you look in there and you look at the ZIL files, so there are ZIL files, ZAP files, and Zabster files. Don't worry about the ZAP and the Zabster. But the ZIL files, you can actually kind of see that it is actually kind of English. If you look like on Earth, in the Earth.zil file, you'll see that, you know, there's, you know, you can actually read the English. And that's the part that Douglas Adams would do is the English, where, you know, you can't enjoy this properly until it's at least 100 years old. And it's basically saying what happens when the user types something and what conditions have to be met for that to happen. So, but a lot of it is so esoteric. That's why Steve was brought in to do some of the actual programming stuff and hooking things together. But Douglas Adams could go in there and actually change the text. And the thing about it being not user-friendly is that was actually a lot of the games at the time, even in the early Sierra days, going, you know, 10 years after the Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, the early Sierra texted or the Sierra graphical adventures like your King's Quest and Police Quest and Space Quest and stuff like that. It's because the games were not that long. If you just go through them, that there were always 50, 60, 70, 80 different ways to die. And that's how they felt you got your money's worth. And it's just Hitchhikers took that to a much further way, because what Hitchhikers would do, what Douglas Adams would do, is if you didn't pick up something in like the first three turns of the game, you can't get the Babelfish,
yes,
you know, 50 or 60 turns later. And that's kind of what he would do, where other games like Zork didn't really do that to you. But Hitchhikers, it's like, oh, if you don't do this right at the very beginning, you know, 3 hours later, you're going to be stuck and dead and you've got to start all the way back over.
And we will talk a bit more about the gameplay with you in a moment, but mm-hmm. We talked last episode about how Infocom also would produce what they call the feelies to, yes, go with a game release, and you had these, I believe.
Yes, so there's actually, and I guess you guys will link it, I actually, because my show, my podcast, my video game podcast, we do it on Twitch now, so there's video, and one towel day last year, I actually pulled out my, and I've got it actually, it's an audio podcast, but that's it right here, I actually pulled it out for this. My original Commodore 64 version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it cost me $34.95, or it cost my dad $34.95, let's be clear here, from a software city. And it actually, Infocom actually put a whole bunch of stuff in this thing. I have everything in here except the disc. So I don't actually have the original disc. It's probably in a disc box somewhere with bit rot, so it's probably not readable anymore. But they've actually got, there's a big instruction manual, which you don't get in video games anymore. Instruction manual, but I've got some paper sunglasses. I've got a microscopic fleet, which is a little ball of cotton. Don't tell anybody. The microscopic space fleet is just it's an empty bag because it's microscopic. You can't see it. There's a cotton ball. I got a dope panic button. I've got orders for the destruction of Earth in both English and Vogon, glossy and stuff. So yeah, no, they actually packed a whole bunch of stuff. Infocom always did because they had no graphics. So that's what you could use to be able to see some of the stuff in the game. And Infocom also did this. One of my favorites was Leather Goddess of Phobos had a scratch and sniff card. And the game would tell you to scratch off certain things. And you never knew if it was going to be a good smell or a very horrible smell.
So your visuals were the things that came along with the game. I like that.
Yes, yes. And now we call that collector's editions,
right,
in the video game world. But this was just how they shipped.
And of course, you mentioned one of the hardest challenges in the game, the Babelfish, mm-hmm, where, as you say, if you hadn't picked up certain items early on in the game, you weren't going to be able to do the challenge, because Infocom also marketed a t-shirt for that, didn't they?
Yes, that was also a big thing that game companies would do, is if you got something, you would get a physical item in return. Infocom did it with the Babelfish. Activision used to do this with patches. You would send in a Polaroid of your video screen of your score, and then they would send you a patch. So that was something that a lot of the companies did in the day to have more engagement outside of the TV screen.
And what about the walkthrough guides that would appear? Was that, did they start appearing in computer magazines for the Hitchhiker's Guide game?
There were hint books and things. I remember that.
Yeah, no, there were, because it was so pedantic. And then now you can just go online and find them, and people have made them, because that's still a big online thing, is people making walkthroughs. And in the past, it would be text walkthroughs. Now we do video YouTube walkthroughs in the video games industry. But yeah, no, you would get those because people would just be so stuck, and they paid $34.95 like my dad did, and not be able to get past the game. And I don't know if this had like a 1-800 number. I know Sierra had like a 1-800 number here in the U.S. that you would call to be able to get hints. And I'm pretty sure Infocom probably had something similar. But yeah, then magazines would just print some hints or just complete walkthroughs.
I think in a way what stood out with the Hitchhiker's game was that it had Douglas Adams' wit and Douglas Adams' sense of humor really infused into it. And because he was such an avid computer person himself, it meant that he knew something about how video games were structured, and it would be a very Douglas Adams way of being stuck in some situation of, for example, not being able to get the Babelfish as a robot grabs it and runs off through a crack in the wall or something like that.
Right. Yeah, and that's why him being paired with Moretzky was good, because Moretzky also got his humor. So they kind of complemented each other in that way. And a lot of people even said that they couldn't tell where Douglas Adams' writing ended and Moretzky's began. So that was a high compliment. But yeah, Douglas Adams being very involved was kind of a first for the game industry, having somebody like that actually involved in the computer game adaptation, because that was not really something that everybody was interested in being a part of in the early 80s.
Yeah, and Douglas Adams was sort of a very avid computer person very early on, particularly with Apple computers. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was certainly very interested in that. And I think he also particularly liked the idea of having different variant versions of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that would not only be on different platforms, but would be allowed to, you know, have slightly different stories and go in slightly different directions. And from, you know, starting in 78 through 84, so 6 years there, you had the radio series and then a second series of the radio series. You had television, you had the first four books, you had LPs, you know, record versions were in there, and you had this text adventure as well. So there was a lot happening in Hitchhiker's related things in a fairly short period of time. And I think doing all of these different approaches was something that Douglas Adams sort of thrived on at that point.
Mm-hmm. So, Bobby, we've mentioned that the Infocom feelies were what you had for visuals. Tell us a little bit about the idea of a text adventure game, because anybody who's seen the BBC's sort of website updating will have seen some visuals, but you didn't have any of those, of course.
Correct. So the term that we use nowadays is interactive fiction. And there's actually a very large, not a very large community, but a decently sized community that still does interactive fiction today, where it's writers that will write stories that have branching paths and narratives. And essentially it gives you a paragraph or two of text of where you are, and then you type in simple commands. And that would be how you would interact with the game. So you would say look, and that would look around. You could look at something, you could take something, and you could move in a cardinal direction. So the way that they were able to update with this with graphics is because we have these source files. There are rooms. They are just able to add graphics on top of a room area. And that's where the graphics would come in later. But that was basically what the text adventure loop was, because it was originally created for teletype machines. So it would actually print out on a printer back in the 70s. And then you would type back into on the typewriter, and then the computer would spit out the next line. And that's how you would play, because not everybody had a graphical screen in the 60s and 70s. A lot of times all you had was a printer, a teletype, or whatever.
Yeah, so it really was quite purely text. You were We're looking at text output and responding in text and getting into the sort of interactive fiction and these ideas. It has something in common with the old choose your own adventure novels that were sort of coming out around the same time in the 70s.
Yes, it really was. It was a more complex choose your own adventure novel. Although don't say that, because as we've learned recently, Choose Your Own Adventure Company, they don't like it when video games call themselves Choose Your Own Adventures. So
yes, that phrase is quite protected. And there were in books as well, there were other names for saying that were used by other companies. You know, it would be a choice story or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Netflix learned that pretty hard in the past, like 2 years ago, that they can't say Choose Your Own Adventure.
And how well did the game sort of engine understand your text inputs? Was it pretty well, you know, was it pretty good for 1984?
It was. It depended on, you know, what they thought of. So, and I'm actually looking through, and I'm going through the source code as well right now, to, because there is a verbs thing, and I'm trying to see if I can figure out where they have some of the synonyms. But they put in a couple synonyms for things. But it really depends on what they thought the player would do. Now, here's the thing about software development, and this is in general. If you try to make something idiot-proof, the world will just build a better idiot. Now, I'm pretty sure that Douglas Adams didn't care if you were an idiot or not. He was not going to idiot-proof his game. But it did, it, you know, they had various ways of saying take something. They would call, you know, you could call, put an adjective, and they would have various adjectives you could put that would go to the same thing for certain characters or certain items. So they did the best they could. I mean, it's not AI. It's not as complex as we probably thought it were when we were younger. We thought, oh, it can understand complete English speech. It really can't. It's pulling out specific words and trying to figure out if that word is what they expected. And if they didn't expect that word, it just killed you. The game just killed you.
Yeah, you could get to, I don't understand what this means, quite quickly in it.
Yes.
And of course, the BBC website now does remind you to save often, because the game will kill you quite frequently.
Yes. And that was even something in the original game as well. It said save often.
Right. And so is it, or was it, as hard as its reputation has been over the years? Was it a tough game of the type or not so?
Yes, it was very tough at the time. In fact, when I first played it as a kid, I never got out of the house. So when that Commodore 64 version, I never made it out of the house. I was also very young, and I also had not read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because I think that helps, is if you've read the books very recently, really, like, especially in the beginning, you have to retrace Arthur Dent's steps.
Right.
Exactly as it is in the book. And even in the 2005 movie, it's a lot of the same stuff. So, you know, not having read the books, I don't know what's going on. I don't have any context. So that it's very difficult. And then it's only mildly difficult if you were, you know, really much into the books, because then Douglas Adams just changes it, because to his mind, changing the books is perfectly okay. That's one of the things he's okay with.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, he makes it seem like, oh, I know where this is going. And he's like, no, you don't. You really don't. So, yes, it was, and it was a lot of frustration because, yes, save often, but don't overwrite your old saves, because sometimes you may need to go all the way back to the beginning and then replay and try to remember what you did, which at that time, if you weren't writing down everything you were doing, you had to remember how you got that far in the game if you had to go all the way back to go pick up the junk mail because you forgot.
I was going to say, you need the junk mail from Arthur's house at the start of the game to get the Babelfish. Is that right?
Yes, wow. That is one of the things you need for the Babelfish.
Right.
And you need the satchel as well, I believe. There were a few things. But doing multiple saves and not overwriting them is great. But if you were on a Commodore 64, for example, you might not be able to hold that many saves in your disk.
Correct. Yeah. No. And so you can do as many as you want now if you have, like, the FROTS interpreter, I think is the way it's what it's called. Yeah, FROTS, FROTZ, FROTS. And then you can get the actual Hitchhiker's Zill files, and it will actually, that's basically, it's a Zill interpreter that's been created today to read a lot of the old files. And you can have as many save files as you want there because our hard drives are so much bigger now. But yeah, you need the, what is it, the gown, the junk mail, the towel, the satchel, and that'll get you the Babel Fish. So spoiler alert.
Yes. And the number of steps that you have, different things that you have to do with all of these items are quite convoluted as well.
Yes.
And again, that was something that I think Douglas Adams must have loved doing. And the biggest way that this sort of stands apart from other versions of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is the sort of convoluted ways of doing these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. That and there's also a time limit. So every time you do something, a clock ticks down and then something else happens. So you can't fumble around looking for how do I see in my bedroom, because if you take too many turns, the bulldozer comes in and that's the end of the game. So he, because a lot of the stuff in here, every time you do something, time ticks and it, yes, doesn't wait for you. And that's something he also loved a lot as well, because that can just frustrate people. And he loved that.
Apart from the Babel Fish, what were the other sort of notable moments from the game that you remember?
Well, one of the things that happens in it, and I was not able to get all the way through it recently. So, but I do know that some of the stuff, especially looking through the source code, so I'm cheating and looking at the source code, is that you do actually return to earlier areas as other characters.
Yes.
So one of the things that can happen is that you can return to Earth as Ford Prefect. And then what you did as Arthur actually affects what happens when you're back there as Ford. It actually remembers the things you did in the steps you took as Arthur, and then so that gets replayed as you're basically seeing it again as Ford. So I thought that was actually kind of neat when I was seeing how they were doing that here under the hood, even if I personally never got to that part.
Yes, I do wonder what proportion of people actually got to the point of doing the other characters, because that required getting through a lot in this game.
And it looks like it's random as well, like which one you go back to.
Oh, interesting.
Because I think there's several areas that you would go back to, and it picked like one of four areas that you would go inhabit another character.
Yeah, and as we mentioned in our previous episode, this covers something like half a book. It doesn't go all the way through the first book. It covers, I think it's probably two or three episodes of the radio series, something like that. And the way that there's more content there is partly because you have all of these very difficult and complex things to do, and also because you get to go back and play as different characters. I think there are a total of, is it four playable characters or three?
So it looks like it's, you go to Damogran as Zaphod, Earth as Ford, the party as Trillian, and then there's Trawl, and then the War Chamber and Maze, it looks like, are the random scenarios.
Okay, so there are a number of different characters you can go through if you get that far.
Yes.
So, Bobby, have you had a chance to look at, because obviously the game has appeared in various different, I suppose, formats over the years on the BBC site, but also on Douglas Adams' site. Have you had a chance to look at the more updated ones with graphics at all?
I will admit I have not. I am very much a purist, so I went back and looked at the original version that I remember playing. So I did not go look at the updated versions.
Okay. How long were you confined to the house for back in 1984-85?
I got in trouble a lot, so probably a lot.
How long were you on the game?
So I probably gave up pretty quickly. I was not old enough to really be able to focus on it at that time. So I probably gave up after about an hour or so. It was my dad's game. I don't know how much my dad got into it. So and he's not around anymore to ask. I probably gave up pretty quickly because I didn't know the books. I didn't know the movies. I was quite young in 1984.
So did your dad come to it through Hitchhiker's Guide, or was he an early adopter of computer games himself?
So my dad was he was an electrical engineer, and so he was actually into computers and the engineering side of things very early on. I'm sure we had an Altair in the 70s. He had a VIC-20. We went to the VIC-20 to the Commodore 64. So he was the one buying a lot of the games in the initial days. And then I was, you know, learning how to program on them. So my dad was already into computers. He wound up being a, you know, wrote the book on, you know, little used now database programming language, toured the country, given seminars on it. So he was really into computers and he was the one who got me into it. So he liked British humor. For some reason, he didn't like Doctor Who, but, you know, Hitchhikers, Monty Python, he was huge into like Flying Circus. So he loved the British humor, which is probably why he got the Hitchhikers game, was because he really did like the British humor for everything except Doctor Who for whatever reason.
Okay. And I mean, if you were to go back and pick from this era of text-based adventure games or interactive fiction, as they're now called, what would be the highlights from that era, from perhaps from Infocom or wider?
So I didn't really start playing the adventure games, unfortunately, until the Sierra era. So these were the early graphical adventure games. So that's a little bit later. That's about, we're talking like 88, 89. So we're talking about 4 or 5 years later.
Right.
So like the big ones for me were the Space Quest series and the Police Quest series. And really, my dad didn't want to give me the Birds and the Bees talk, so it was also the Leisure Suit Larry series. But he did have Leather Goddess of Phobos as well. So I remember that from the Infocom days. But I didn't really grow up on the Infocom stuff. I was already playing graphical games on Commodore 64 or on my Nintendo Entertainment System. I was a little bit too young to appreciate Infocom when they were at their peak.
Do you see the Hitchhiker's Guide game as one of the landmark moments or one of the highlights of text adventure games in general? Or was it just sort of one of the minor things that happened along the way?
I think it was landmark because of Douglas Adams' involvement, and it was probably the most well-known out of all the ones that Infocom did. I mean, they did a lot of great ones that, you know, as, you know, video game historians look back and they're like, oh, you know, all the Zorks were great and all the other stuff they did was great. But people didn't recognize it outside of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I think giving, having Douglas Adams go on TV, go on the BBC and talk about it, it was great for the visibility of the medium. And I think that's where it stands, is that it raised awareness of computer games as storytelling devices, more so than anything else that Infocom did, because it was a licensed property from a very well-known author.
And does, you know, it's the big question, does Douglas Adams' sort of wit come through in the text-based adventure, do you think?
I do, because he did write a lot of the stuff. He worked with Steve, and there are even stuff in here that he's added about, like, in the junk. If you pick up the junk mail, it actually says, yeah, you get this thing for this company called Infocom trying to, you know, sell you stuff. You know, so that's in there. So if you pick up the mail on the front porch, it says there are many pieces of mail. Most are from some computer company called Infocom, which wants you to buy their games. Hidden underneath is an official letter from the council, and that talks about the stuff you remember from the story. So he would interject things about that self-awareness and stuff like that. So that really does go through, and Douglas Adams approved of it. And so that's why I do think it actually goes through. And there were the comments that Steve Moretzi also got his humor and was able to write into it.
Very nice. So we should get into a little bit more of our own thoughts on this and what we liked and didn't like. So Eamon, I'll start with you. We'll get to you in a minute, Bobby. Eamon, what did you like, or what do you like about the idea of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure?
Well, I'm a terrible gamer. So as everybody knows, I think I didn't get out of the bedroom. That's it within game and, you know, I suppose elsewhere as well. But I like the fact that it has this sort of surrounding fun aspect to it, the Douglas Adams nature of it. I like the fact that you got those feelies, which all were sort of nice little jokes from the books and the radio series and so on. And I love the fact that the BBC have continued that and kept it fun and funny. And even to the extent that when you die on the BBC version, the game tweets about it, which is delightful. So I like all that part. I can't really comment on the gameplay because I'm just no good at it, I'm afraid. What about you, Brian?
I agree with a lot of that. What I like is that it's not a generic game with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy written at the top. It is really infused with not only Douglas Adams' sense of humor, but also the world of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the story, the characters. It is very much one of the versions of Hitchhikers, and it is infused with that as opposed to just being a game that is nominally Hitchhikers. So that was something I liked a lot.
What about you, Bobby? What's the best bits about it?
So I pretty much kind of already said it all. So, but it's that it raised the awareness. I think it's more the cultural impact of it than the game itself, because like I said, I didn't, when it came out, I wasn't old enough to appreciate it. I didn't grow up with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, the books or any the dramas that were out, the radio stuff. I got into that later in life. But basically, you know, I'd be echoing what you guys said, that Douglas Adams was heavily involved with it and gave his seal of approval. And, you know, just the cultural impact of that. It really was one of the first ones where the author was really into this medium that I love, that the video, you know, and it really started the video game industry. And this was not the last video game Douglas Adams worked on. But, you know, so it moved my medium forward that I now kind of spend a lot of my life in nowadays. So it's really the cultural impact.
That's great. So, Bobby, what did you not like? What did you feel were the drawbacks or the weaknesses with the Hitchhiker's text adventure?
So the real weakness is also Douglas Adams, because he took the idea of there has to be lots of deaths a little bit further than most other game designers would, because he's Douglas Adams and he can. So, you know, I'm not trying to bash the game for it, but that is a weakness, is that it does artificially inflate the time it takes to complete, because it does have all the pedantic moves. And, you know, you got to get something in the first three turns of the game to be able to progress an hour or two later. That's not good game design, but we didn't really know that at the time. And if Douglas Adams knew that wasn't good game design, he didn't really care. So that's probably the weakness from somebody who maybe doesn't appreciate Douglas Adams and his humor as much. You know, if they just came into this and didn't know, they would say that's a big weakness, is that the game design is actually not very good, but it is good for Douglas Adams. And that's what matters here.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I think for me, the weak points, one is that I just wasn't able to get very far with it because I'm not particularly good at this, and it is very hard. But the other thing would be that it includes these other character perspectives after Arthur, which is great, but so many players just don't get to see those because of the difficulty and the complexity. So it would have been, I guess, nice if those parts of it were more accessible.
Yeah, it's too hard for me, I'm afraid, as everybody can tell listening to this. But yes, I do like the fact that the Hitchhiker's Guide is a very sort of multivariate thing that exists in a number of different formats, and each one slightly different. But yeah, it is a hard game. Douglas Adams, yes. What did he call it? Not just user unfriendly, user mendacious, he called it, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. But I will say that if you revisit it today, all you got to do is look for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text game walkthrough. And there's actually a good one on IGN that will walk you through how to see everything and what you need to do. So you can kind of just sit there and follow along. If you want to follow along and experience the story, you can do that. It will actually tell you, lie down, do this. You know, type this exact sentence, which sometimes you have to do, you know, and it walks you through so you can get the full amount of points and you can see just about everything other than the random. It takes you to one of four places, so it walks you through each of those four random places. But that way you can experience the full story today. You can do that, and there's guides online that you don't have to pay for anymore.
And of course, it is free now on the BBC site as well. You can play it for free.
Nice. So I think we're at the point to give our recommendations now. I will start this one. I will say that yes, I recommend this as something to try out on the BBC site and see what it looks like. I would not recommend it as your first introduction to Hitchhikers. I would say go with maybe the radio series as your first. But it's an interesting look at a different perspective of things. So definitely, I would say try it out on the BBC site and possibly look at one of these walkthroughs if that's what you like, if you want to see a bit more.
What about you, Bobby? Would you recommend going back to the original text-based version?
Well, yes, I would. Now, what I will also say is, you know, you already said don't make it your first introduction to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I would also say don't make this your first introduction to interactive fiction or text adventures. Try some other text adventures first, and you can even look at stuff that's even made more recently called at the Interactive Fiction Competition. So if you go to ifcomp.org, ifcomp.org, you can actually find text adventures, interactive fiction, some that are even using that Zork interpretive language, ZIL, and you can play them, and they're not as difficult, but it teaches you how to use a text parser, what they're looking for, stuff like that, and you can get used to playing them, and then go back and play Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Or if you want to stick in the 80s, try to play some Zork or, you know, some of the other Infocom games before going to Hitchhiker's. You don't have to do too much, but just get yourself used to it, because if you jump right into Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, never having done a text adventure or interactive fiction game before, you're going to be doubly lost, and that's, you're not going to enjoy it as much as if you have some grounding in the medium.
But you do recommend checking out the Hitchhiker's game at some point.
Yes, yes.
Eamon?
Oh, well, I'm going to say it's free on the BBC, and the BBC has preserved the humour, and it's got some nice new graphics that were designed by a competition winner. So, yeah, I'd say give it a go. If you're like me, you'll need to have the walkthrough open on a tab as well. But, yeah, it's free. And I will put the link that Bobby's just mentioned to ifcomp.org on the Facebook page when this episode comes out. So, yeah, I think we're a sort of three thumbs up for this one, Brian.
Sounds good. So, in summary, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy introduced us to Arthur Dent and other characters and the destruction of the Earth at the hands of a Vogon constructor fleet, and we move on through the story from there. This text adventure version gave us an interactive approach that allowed us to be Arthur Dent and to go through various challenges to forward the story. And in fact, it allows us to go back as other characters and go through a variety of pieces that cover roughly half of the first book or first radio series of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Let us know if you got the Babelfish. And come back next time and join us when we're on one of our yearly trips into the worlds of Gerry Anderson. We're looking at a stop motion animation show of his called Lavender Castle from the ITV in 1999.
That will be a fun one to talk about, and it's always interesting to look at some of these later Gerry Anderson shows. So something to look forward to for next time. Until then, you can find all of our episodes, all 350 of them, at BritishInvaders.com, including our original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy television series episodes. Or if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find our group there, and we always have some fun discussions, and you can tell us if you got the Babelfish.
Absolutely. And of course, regular listeners will know at this point, I normally say that we're proud members of the VOG network, Voice of Geeks, and then I usually say a line about it. But this time, I'm going to throw it to you, Bobby. Tell us all about the Voice of Geeks network.
Yeah, so the Voice of Geeks network is a podcast network and streaming network all about geek culture. So we are at vognetwork.com, vognetwork.com. And I am one of the co-founders, and I also host a video game podcast, and we actually tape it live in front of a live Twitch audience. So we made the switch to do our live shows instead of over internet radio. We're doing it over video. It's still an audio podcast, so my show is called The Bobby Blackwell Show. Worst name ever for a video game show, but it is what it is. I've been doing it for just a little bit over 15 years now. I had celebrated my 15-year anniversary last week. I record it live on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and I believe that's 1 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah, so I think it's 5 hours, I think. So trying to do that in my head. So I understand that if most people over in Europe can't attend live, but I am on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, TuneIn, anywhere that you get podcasts, I am on there. And I talk about the video game industry. I talk about, things going on mostly on the industry side more than the actual playing of the game side. So it's a lot of different things each week. And I have actually talked about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy before and shown my feelies. So you can find that on also on my Twitter page. I'm at Bobby Blackwolf just about everywhere.
Excellent stuff. Thank you so much for being our guest and giving us the expert knowledge on the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, Bobby.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have one of the Vogons here.
Do I need to read you some poetry?
Not this time. That comes in the next guest appearance.
Okay.
So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is Bobby Blackwolf from Atlanta in the U.S., signing off.
And from Ava in England, until next time, it's obviously so long, and thanks for all the fish.